Thank you very much. So this is an experiment. I'm venturing out of my official field of expertise. We wrote a paper about a year ago together with Igor Klebanov, Sanit Staki, and Peter O'Young. And I will talk quite a bit about that, but also I'd like to give a general overview of this subject, which I find confusing, but also very fascinating. Originally, I had prepared a talk on strings in low dimensions, and I do not want to give the impression, I think, that the subject of strings in low dimensions is not interesting. It's beautifully interesting. ADS-FT, as probably has been emphasized many times here, is a toy model for QCD, and strings in low dimensions are a toy model for ADS-FT. And so it's like a couple of, or maybe 3 degrees of separation. This I thought would be certainly for me more fun to prepare because I don't know much, so it was an occasion to learn more. And I hope this QCD part of the audience will not get too offended if I start talking about things that I'm not supposed to really know very well. So we have seen in the last few years a renaissance of hadron spectroscopy. This used to be considered one of the most boring and dead subjects in particle physics. And in fact, there are big news. You may have heard that new measures have been discovered. Some of these states are C bar S, some are CC bar. But the focus of this talk will be on the perhaps even more exciting discovery of exotic baryons. And of course, we all know that QCD is the corrective of the strong interactions. So we're not going to learn a new fundamental theory by this kind of analysis. But it's also clear that there are many things that we really do not understand, even at a qualitative level, how to derive spectroscopy from fundamental principles. And in fact, I think one of the lessons is that comes from this discovery is that they remind us of how little we know, because we really do not understand even some basic qualitative facts about these new states, if they really exist. So, in fact, a talk about exotics in QCD should start with the remark of how remarkable it is that there are no exotic states in QCD, except perhaps the newly discovered exotic baryons, but those must be understood in a framework where we also understand how few exotics there are. And what is an exotic state? Of course, in QCD, the number of quarks of separate flavors are conserved. So we can assign a valence quark structure, which means a minimal quark content that accounts correctly for the quantum numbers. And in fact, Gell-Mann, in his original paper on the quark model back in 1964, observed how funny it was that all the observed states appear to be just capture, assuming that they are QQ bar or QQQ. And of course, those are SU3 colored singlets, but there are lots of other ways in which you can form SU3 colored singlets. And the question is, why are these things not there? Okay, thank you. So just to remind the string theory part of the audience, I've written down the basic quark content of some famous particle, the proton, the neutron, the K plus, the K minus, the K zero, and the K zero bar. They will play a role in the following. And I wanted to remind you that by some historic accident, strangeness is defined the wrong way. So positive strangeness means that you have S bar in your state. So it does appear, by and large, that there are no exotics in the real world. And the big news is, in fact, that perhaps there are a few. And the original discoveries from January 2003 were this low-energy lab in Japan. They produce Phi meson for a living. They were stimulated by some theoretical work that will feature very prominently in the following. So they look for the state in their data. And they claim to have found, indeed, an exotic state, a strangest plus one baryon resonance, which is now called theta plus. And the surprising thing is light and narrow. So the minimal quark content you assign from quantum numbers, UUDD S bar, And clearly, there is no way you could subtract a quark-antiquark pair to make it of the canonical structure. And of course, again, we all know, of course, that QCD is a these bound states are complicated relativistic bound states. So there are people discuss such things as the C, the strange C of the nucleon. Of course, we all know that SS bar pairs are there and they contribute significantly to the nucleon mass. But this is really different. This is a state which is manifestly exotic. So these are data. That's the fun part of the talk. So the way people look for these things, very surprisingly, they found them in photoproduction. They scatter photon. They have some Compton backscattering. So they tag the energy of the photon and they throw it onto some nuclear target. And this is the reaction which one looks at. The photon goes to the neutron. And so, of course, strangeness is conserved, so you produce k plus, k minus. You only observe the charged particles, not the neutron, but you can reconstruct, of course, by using special relativity, you can reconstruct such things like the invariant mass. The left figure is invariant mass in k minus n, and the right figure is invariant mass in k plus n. And in k minus n, you see something you do expect to see. You see a peak at a famous resonance, the lambda 1520, which we'll see later again. And here, if these data are correct, you see a peak in a place where nothing was supposed to be there, a peak in k plus n. So k plus n has precise exotic quantum numbers of UU DD S bar. And this suggests that there is a resonance state with these quantum numbers, and it's clearly a baryon because there's a neutron, it's positive strange because there's a k plus, and that's what you call the discovery of the theta plus. But you should keep in mind that this is a 19 events type of discovery, and to get here they had to apply rather drastic cuts to exclude other resonances that are around. So a more, what people consider a somewhat more reliable experiment is the one done at Jefferson Lab. You see, all these plots are kind of bumpy. I mean, it's not totally obvious to me that you should select this peak over this peak, but these people know better. And here, the reaction is fairly similar. You do gamma again deuteron, and really, in the deuteron, the proton is just a spectator, but you want to see it in order to say that you're accepting the right thing. And this is the little diagram that shows the reaction you're looking for. And again, you look for the invariant mass of k plus n, and here is your resonant peak. So this is a summary of the experimental data. By now, there are maybe 10 different experiments that claim to have seen it. There are some fun inconsistencies. Some experiments, the one they use photon, try to one say that it's a little bit heavier than the one they use other type of projectiles or targets. But the really surprising thing is how, if it is really there, it is how light and how narrow it is. So these are, apart from these measures, which are most people would not believe, all these just put an upper limit on the width. But of course, people have been throwing k plus onto matter since remote antiquity. And if you look at this old data, there's absolutely nothing there. So you can phrase this negative result as an upper limit on the width. And the way this works is actually kind of beautiful. In this material, really, you never have a free nucleon there. For example, in the deuteron case, the nucleon. As some intrinsic distribution which you do to Fermi motion. So suppose that the theta plus has a very small width, and the width you really measure is going to be smeared out over the fact that your target is not at rest. But in smearing out the width, if you have some kind of cross section, which is the width times the height, if you smear it out, the height is going to decrease. So since you see nothing, you conclude that the only way this could be is that if the width is so narrow that in this process of being smearing out, the peak just becomes very flat. But this is just a negative result, which is phrases an upper limit on the width. And if the width is more than one MeV, you have not seen a hadron that decays strongly with such a small width. It's something from a different planet. And on the other hand, there are experiments with extremely high statistics. This is the plus and minus, and also this is, you know, in these B factories that were invented for other purpose, but you can look at the decay of a B meson and basically produce anything in the book. I mean, you do E plus and minus at the threshold for some resonance of BB bar, and you produce anything in the book which has the allowed quantum numbers, or since it's E plus and minus, you just produce something and its corresponding antiparticle. And this is sort of to impress you how remarkable this is. I believe that the peak in this non-resonance contains something like 50,000 events. And you go look where the newbies should be, and you see absolutely nothing. So again, here you reconstruct the invariant mass of the decay products. This is proton k0 short. So you reconstruct this very well because the proton is charged, and the k0 decays in pi plus pi minus. And there is absolutely nothing. So this is puzzling. And this is another marvelous experiment. So one excuse that people make here is that this beast is complicated, has five quarks, and as I will mention later, presumably their wave function is not of the usual type. So you may have a hard time in popping out quarks out of the vacuum, quark antiquark out of the vacuum, and arranging them the right way. So what these measures could really tell you is that just it's extremely hard, the state is just extremely hard to produce. And in fact, though, there are limits which are really kind of from this experiment, they didn't deduce that the probability to produce is like 10 to the minus 4 for each QQ bar event. It's more than that, I mean. So it's harder to make an excuse for this experiment. So this is a beautiful thing. You can tell that I have sort of the enthusiasm of the neophyte. So the way this experiment is, so Bell produces lots of things, and among the many things it produces, there are secondary kaons, things that just get produced in this E plus E minus annihilation. And what these plots are the, this is the special section of the detector which is reconstructed by looking at vertex of a kaon decaying to something, doing something else. So this is the vertex from which the secondary kaon beams originates. And you see that this tracks exactly the shape of the detector, because basically you're just using the detector as your target itself. These are kaons which just pop out from a point of the detector from secondary beams. And then you can play the same game. You look at the invariant mass. In PK plus, there are no relevant quantum, these are not quantum numbers you expect to see anything, there's nothing. In PK minus, you see again our favorite state lambda 1520. And PK, if there was the pentaquark, you ought to see it. And this thing here is something like 15,000 events. So there is absolutely nothing. So the thing is extremely confusing. And you see here, this is not a E plus E minus experiment. These are secondary kaons which have fairly low momentum. So this is sort of some kind of non-relative. Really, here you're doing it the way you're trying to produce, say, the way you would think you produce it. Just throw kaons to nuclei, and if this is a kaon nuclei resonance, you should produce it, and you don't.
What do you speak on the right
feature? This is the lambda 1520. So this is a negative parity hadronic resonance, which is a famous one. So this is just a negative strangeness baryon that people have known about forever. Sorry? Well, it should show here as well. No, here it shouldn't, because it's PK plus. It should show here. Because the K short will contain, I mean, of course, the K short is a mixture of K and K0 and K0 bar, but well, nevertheless, if there is something, you should see it. So, okay, that concludes the experimental part of my talk, and now we go to theory. So, these developments were motivated by a remarkable paper from these three Russian authors who predicted that they should be there based on collective coordinate quantization of the SU3 chiral solitor model, which is going to be the subject of my talk. And they made this remarkable prediction. They said there should be a state with the mass that was essentially observed, where the 10 MeV less, and should have a very small width. And let me flash this picture from their paper. We will discuss this later again. So this is they call the Z plus. It's now called the theta, and it belongs to an SU3 anti-decuplet. So remember the decuplet, which is the ordinary variance with which the delta belongs, is sort of the bottom-up picture, and this has been the anti-decuplet. The state is at the top. And actually, there have been also claims of people. There's only one experiment that claims to have seen this state. This state has Strange's -2. And so if you think about it for a second, a Strange -2 state also is manifest exotic. You cannot make it just with 3 quarks. You need 5. But only one experiment sees, and similar experiments should see a thing. And there's also one claim of a charmed pentaquark, but again, it's only one experiment. Instead, this guy here, as we have seen, there are at least 10 different experiments claim to see it. So we should try to understand it. So let me remind you now that we switch gears, we go back to the realm of theory, this marvelous idea that goes back to Skirman, Witten, wrote some beautiful papers in the early 80s, that we should be able to think of baryons as solitons in a low-energy effective Lagrangian for the Goldstone boson of QCD, which are, of course, the pions. So let's first set the mass of the quarks to zero so that these are real Goldstone bosons. U is the usual field, which is the exponential of the pion fields. And of course, this is a derivative expansion that contains infinitely many terms. I've written the conventional way in which people study this action, that the most popular model is Kerme model, in which you make a specific choice of a higher derivative term that you add to the Lagrangian. This particular term, as opposed to other terms of the same order you may add, is singled out by the fact that it comes by integrating out the rho. And it does seem to play a bigger role just experimentally. This accounts more or less for the low energy interaction of pions quite accurately. And then, of course, you could add higher derivative terms as much as you like, and really, as you probe higher and higher energy, the thing never stops. You're not justified to ignore these higher terms. And if we want to describe baryons, really, well, we should keep in mind that really there is a lot of dynamic hidden here. And the other reason why this simple term, however, is singled out is that the only term that upon expansion leads to a Hamiltonian, which is, well, you can do simple Hamiltonian quantization because you only have it's linear in time, quadratic in time derivatives. Otherwise, things get complicated if not. And of course, this term is the Vesumino term that is you need to match for anomaly matching, and it's written in the five-dimensional form that Witten invented. And so what is the idea here? Is the idea that, okay, you have this infinite derivative expansion. This describes the low-energy interaction of the pseudo-Goldstone bosons. And what are baryons? Baryons are topologically non-trivial configurations. So if we restrict to the case of SU3 flavor, we may take this SU2 ansatz in which this is the first two components, just a usual isospin that rotates the U and D quark. And this is the famous hedgehog ansatz that sort of glue together rotations in space with rotations in SU2 direction. And of course, if you work a little bit, you can find explicitly this functional form of F. But the point being, of course, that this object has a non-trivial P3 of SU3 is non-trivial, and you identify the winding number with the baryon number of your soliton. So these are familiar things. So since, of course, let's now for as a warm-up do the SU2 case, in which we just have two flavors, so I'm just restricting to this upper dimensional corner. Well, of course, the U naught guy has collective coordinates that we need to quantize, as the usual story with solitons. So the way we do that, we write down this kind of ansatz where we take A of t to be slowly varying, and We can canonically quantize the rotation. So here, actually, I think there is a typo. This could go from 0 to 3, but there is a constraint. And the constraint is precisely that this is the Laplacian on the sphere. So you get this simple Hamiltonian that tells you that there is a classical mass given by the mass of the soliton, and then there are rotational excitations which correspond to the spin of the particle, and in fact of the baryon. And in fact, it's easy to see just by a little procedure that the isospin and the spin are the same. You have a choice of whether to quantize as a boson or as a fermion. For SU2, really, that is a choice. And so to mimic the real world, we quantize it as a fermion, and then I equal j equal a half are the familiar nucleons, that's our ground state, and I equal j equal 3/2 are the deltas. And there's a beautiful story that works marvelously. You describe lots of real physics, a very simple model. So, of course, the underlying reason why this is working and why we're justified to do this is that the chiral Lagrangian scales like, you know, if we start doing large n counting, the whole thing scales like n, because this scales are square root n, and e scales are 1 of square root n, which means that the mass, the classical mass of the soliton and this omega, which is the momentum of inertia, scale like n. So in other terms, for large n, the soliton moves very slowly in this collective coordinate motion. Excitations are light, they're suppressed like 1 over n. And this makes sense. It makes sense in a Born-Oppenheimer sense as a separation of scale between the slow motion of the collective coordinates and the vibrational modes that will be of order 1 LRGN. And we're justified in just neglecting the higher modes LRGN, just quantizing these collective coordinates. And of course, this analysis will break down if you go to spin, which is of order n. In the real world, we don't see anything which is 5/2. That would be already an exotic state. It's an art for the large n expansion, but I presume 5/2 is sufficiently close to 3 that we should not trust that state. Now, things get more fun if you do SU3. For SU3, you can repeat the story, and it turns out that the eighth component, the one associated with the Gell-Malmaison lambda 8, does not appear in your Hamiltonian. But through the Vesdomino term, it gives a constraint on your allowed wake functions. For SU3 also, there is a beautiful fact explained by Witten that if n is odd, you must quantize the state as a fermion. If n is even, you must quantize as a boson. So this explains, in some sense, why you're getting fermions out of this purely bosonic soliton. And this constraint can be translated into a fact that your SU3 mult must constrain state which has zero strangeness. So if we take n to be odd, which is what we are interested in doing for the real-world application, there's another crucial difference with the SU2 case, that these flavor SU3 multiple are depend on n. So in other terms, your baryon, which has, if you think in a quark model picture, which is a sort of a dual picture to the one I'm describing here, then your n quarks can sort of wander out, can be strange quark, and so your baryon in this multiple can have as many as sort of roughly of order n strange quarks. So these are big multiplets that they are the large n analog of, or the arbitrary n analog of this. I'm writing the algebra of the octadecuplet and the antidecuplet I was showing before. And then of course there is an infinite tower. So these are the usual Dinkins label. It tells you how many, you know, you could translate these into standard SU3 representations. But anyway, the point I want to emphasize is that these representations get big in the large n limit, and as soon as you turn on a little bit of mass for the strange quark, clearly you break SU3 very drastically, because by the time you reach the state which has of order n strange quarks, since the strange quark mass is of order 1 for large n, clearly you are breaking the SU3 symmetry very largely. So that's fun. And what these guys did in 1997, in fact, it had been done already in the early 80s, but they did a more careful and beautiful analysis. Well, they stick to n equals to 3, so they were not really interested in doing things at large n. And they said, well, look, here is the octet, here is a decuplet. The next guy is an antidecuplet. Why shouldn't we take that seriously? We have all these states. Of course, in the chiral limit, they're all degenerate, but we can do what Gell-Mann did a long time ago. We turn on an SU3 breaking term to linear order, and then we get equal splitting. And then it's not hard to work out what the equal splitting should be from sort of first principle computing moments of inertia, and also you have to feed it some experimental data like the nucleon sigma that will tell you the part of the nucleon mass which comes from UU bar and DD bar. And so they got a prediction for the splitting, which is 180 MeVs, and they said, look, we believe, because we just make a guess, that this state is some state that is in the PDG, and bing. We predict the existence of this state, and apparently they got it right. So this is fantastic at first sight, but unfortunately it turns out to be wrong. So let me now explain why this is wrong. So it's wrong because essentially the large N reasoning is breaking down. So if you repeat the exercise of computing, this has been known, you know, again since the 80s, I'm not inventing anything. If you compute the masses of these excitations as a function of this PQ, which are the labels of the SUT representation we were showing before, you find this pretty mass formula. These are, again, this moment of inertia, which are of order N. And you can observe fairly easily that if you consider something which you may want to call a non-exotic multiplet, a multiplet you could, in a dual quark model picture, you could mimic by taking QQQ type structure and putting the spin to be a half, three half, and so on, you get this type of mass formula where you see this is of order N, this is of order 1, but this order 1 really doesn't mean anything because what you should look for is this mass splitting between the ground state, which is J equal to 1/2, and the higher states. So mass splittings are of order 1 over N. And in fact, these are precisely the multiplets, and it's precisely the same kind of mass formula as has been known since the 80s, that you get from work of Manohar and others, and you get from the quark model, from the relativistic quark model. The crucial difference of the exotic multiple, like this large analog of the anti-decoupler, it's mass splitting from the ground state is of order 1. And then, basically hell breaks loose, you're not allowed to use this naive reasoning. So this is a point that we made. It had been, to some extent, made already, but we emphasized it in our paper, and Cohen also has emphasized this point very clearly. Since, really, this motion in this direction is fast, there's no Born-Oppenheim separation of scales. You cannot trust the semi-classical treatment of the soliton. And there are many ways to rephrase this. One is looking at the width. So the deltas, since they have a mass split of order 1 over m from the ground state, in the large N limit, they become stable, just from phase space considerations. This is not true for the state. This state, and this tells you that you are quantizing the state inconsistently, because from the rigid rotational quantization, you get a real mass. If the state was unstable, there should be an imaginary part. The fact that the imaginary part is zero tells you that you're doing something wrong. And what you're doing wrong is that you are supposed to, you have a clever ansatz, but the ansatz should be checked for self-consistency, and self-consistency is not here. And we will see in a moment another reason why you should not trust this approximation. So you cannot use this type of large general reasoning to predict exotics. Of course, they may still exist, but then their existence becomes a dynamical question. It's hidden in this infinite series of derivative expansion that is in the Kaya-Lagrange. If they do exist, then you can use large N techniques to constrain certain of their properties and relate, in particular, certain exotic states to other exotic states, a point that has been discussed by Jenks and Manohar, and we will see an example of that shortly. So, So if we go back to the to this picture, well, in some sense, there are some other trivial things that, in retrospect, look a little bit accidental. For example, now these experimental values, like the nucleon sigma term that are used to fit this data, have changed so much that really this value of the mass they got looks really somewhat accidental, even if you were allowed to trust the larger this semi-classical region, which we are not, it looks a bit like a fortunate accident that things work out this way. Of course, if the state really exists, then you have to find a way to explain it. So another point which has been found in the literature, there's been some nasty exchanges between Jaffe and his authors, is in the original calculation, they quoted a width which was 15, more than 15 mm, but it turns out that there is some arithmetic error in their paper, and the width, if you just follow their procedure, is more like something like 30 mEVs, and experimentally we know it's much less than that. So anyway, they deserve a lot of credit for taking this idea seriously, and in particular Dyakonov was the one who really pushed the experimentalists to look for the state. But now we need to reconsider this and go back to first principle and try to understand what's going on. And certainly, you could not have used that reasoning honestly to predict the state. So so what does one do? So Kalan and Klebner in the early 80s suggested a way to improve on this collective coordinate quantization, which is a sort of a very natural idea. Once you realize that as soon as you turn on a little bit the strange quark mass, you're breaking SU3 very strongly, you start thinking that maybe you should really kind of take the opposite limit. What you want to do is to consider your soliton as very, very heavy, and you want bind kaons to it. So what you want to do, the natural thing to try and do, is to expand the action to quadratic order in the kaon field fluctuations around this topologically non-trivial configuration, and then study basically the wave function of kaons in this background. That amounts to studying really how kaons scatter off our soliton, and you get some kind of Schrödinger type equation where there is a linear term that comes from, in time derivative that comes from the Rezzovino term, and it's very crucial, and then some effective potential that depends on the shape of the soliton. So you can work in partial waves, both in isospin and in real spin. And eventually, if you work in a fixed value of the, or you fix the eigenvalues for this isospin and spin, you reduce the problem just to a radial Schrödinger equation. You expand the kaon field into, so remember, this is it's a complex scalar. It's A modes are the one that we associate with the K minus, with the negative strangest guys, and the B modes are the one we associate with the K plus. So because of this funny time derivative, there is no symmetry between A and B, and you really have two separate equations. You see there is a linear term in omega that is different for the negative and positive stringence case. And really there is a very very close analogy of all of this with just a simple problem of Landau levels. Basically, you should think of this Vezzomino term as some kind of magnetic field. And the negative stringence guy is the one that in the chiral limit, the limit of zero mass, goes to the lowest Landau level. And this guy would go to the next level. But then one thing that you immediately realize, indeed, is that if you take the chiral limit, the wave function corresponding to this lowest Landau level smoothly goes over to the zero mode. You can find the exact solution, and it has omega equals zero. But there's no solution to the other equation. So this mode that we found before in this naive collective coordinate quantization that had order one splitting from the ground state is just not there. It's an illusion of doing semi-classical quantization the wrong way. So what we did with Igor, Sunny, and Peter, we look at this model very seriously. And of course, if large N is not all, if you cannot use large N, then you have to make some dynamical assumptions. And the dynamical assumption is to take a specific model, take the Skirman model for a start, and look what that tells about the real world. So in fact, the model works remarkably well. It works much better than you had any right to expect. And in particular, it reproduces beautifully, you know, to the extent that you a few percent errors are not to be taken. Of course, but it does reproduce beautifully the ordinary guys. So, for example, these are bound states. So let me remind you that the nucleon is something like 950 MeVs, and the kaon is something like 595. So here we are below the nucleon kaon threshold. So these objects simply arise by looking at this potential. It's a Schrödinger equation. You look for bound states of this Schrödinger equation. It's a very simple thing to do in Mathematica. And you find some numbers. One beautiful thing of this whole story is that you get the parity right. The lowest state turns out to have positive parity because it's partial wave one. It's a P wave. So the kaon is pseudoscalar. It's a P wave. So you get the lambda with positive parity that it should be. These other guys come from doing the SU2 quantization. So once you've gotten this basic state, now you can get its partners under just the collective quantization of the SU2 part, which is something you're allowed to do. And this other guy is another kind of triumph. It's a lambda 14 of 5, which has the other parity. You get it as an S wave. And well, you see, you should ignore column C. So these things are somewhat overbound. But mass splittings work fairly well, and the very fact you get the right state, you get what you expect, is kind of remarkable. So in fact, this approach also works for not just for bound states, but for resonances. So resonances are found by looking at phase shifts, and this is the famous lambda 1520 whose peaks I've been showing a few times, and here you get it beautifully. You have this beautiful pi shift in the phase, you find the mass, it works out pretty well, you find these isospin partners, things work much better than you had an right to expect. So that corresponds to the various columns here, right? So you can play various games. The one game you can play the game in which you insist in fitting the absolute scale of the soliton mass by the fact that you know the wave profile and you can just compute the soliton mass. That is not a very successful thing to do because presumably the absolute scale is something that gets many quantum corrections. It works better if you give up on fixing that overall scale and take f pi to be the actual experimental value. So basically you can play various games and you can fit things in various ways. So but you know you should not really take, you know, if something works at a 10% level, you should declare triumph, right? The thing is that you're getting the right state. So you're getting the right stuff with the right quantum numbers and with the right hierarchy of masses. So given that we have a dynamical model that reproduces the correct physics in the set that we know and love, I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Pi over 2 is kind of maximal phase, right?
No, in my normalization, pi is what means a resonance.
Well,
okay, we chose normalization such that the resonance is just that I'm sure. So so that's the answer I was giving to Anish. So you can play various games. If you insist in actually reproducing correctly both the nucleon mass and the nucleon delta splitting, then you get f pi to be 129, and this coupling constant is criminal tend to be for 5.45. This was done a long time ago by Atkins, Lappi, and Witten. That is not the most successful thing to do. The most successful thing to do is to ignore the overall scale, say that you're only going to be interested in mass splittings, and then take the f pi to be the experimental value.
Okay, so it's twice of 93.
Oh, okay, that's your question. Oh, yes, it's twice as 93. Some people like 93, and we do 193. But anyway, look, Probably I don't even remember the details of this, but that's not really the point. So the point of this is that now we flip the sign of this magnetic term. And you see, if you have some quark model in which you put springs between the quarks or do some clever, more clever, sophisticated thing, then it becomes a very arbitrary game. What happens when you look in this anexotic setup, because you don't know what the rules are. But here you don't have to invent anything, because all you need to do is to flip the sign of this first derivative term and just fit this into Mathematica, and what you discover is that there is no pentaquark. And so desperate, we are desperate to get it. So what we said, well, maybe by some SU3 breaking effects, the Vesumino term, which in the chiral limit, of course, is just normalized to be an integer, you cannot mess with it, but as soon as you turn on SU3 breaking terms, who knows, all the coefficients will start to drift and normalize. Maybe in the real effective Lagrangian, you're just by 40% change, and then you start to get something that may look like a resonance, but before it really makes it all the way to a pi shift, it becomes bound. So you really cannot get this object honestly in this model, even if you go to a very extreme region of parameter space, which, by the way, would make the previous agreement considerably worse. Or alternatively, you can crank up the kaon mass. Of course, the state you can demonstrate it's simply not there for zero kaon mass. That was the argument I had before. But as you crank up the kaon mass, of course, things will get more bound. And you can, if you are willing to accept that the kaon mass is over 1 GeV, then you can manufacture something that starts looking like a resonance. But really, it's not convincing. So, of course, the Skirman model is a stupid model. It's not QCD. But as a guidance how things are, it's telling you that if you can trust the Large N expansion, so if the real world is close to being a Large N, so you can do some kind of analysis based on the chiral Lagrangian, where you can think of binaries as solitons, and if you need a dynamical input, that these coefficients are not too far from explaining things, then you're not in very good shape. You're not getting the state very well. So if the state is there, this was the point I was saying before, then it comes with partners. Basically, it's SU2 rotations in the isospin direction. And you can derive this sort of model-independent relations from the point of view of multiple of SU3, these are the 27 and whatnot. So you can derive this relation that really have nothing to do with the dynamical details of the chiral soliton model. And in fact, these are just special cases of many more relations that were derived by Jenkins and Manohar by this contracted SU2 and F flavored thing I'm sure you'll hear more about in Anish's talk. So these are the sort of things you can derive reliably at large N. Anything that involves dynamical assumptions is indeed dynamical. So another thing you can do, this is a paper by Park, Rowe, and Min, is to explicitly introduce vector mesons, k-stars. That is an interesting thing to do, because in the limit in which the strange mass becomes very heavy, you gain heavy quark symmetry, and the k-star and the kaon should be generate. So you may think that you're doing something deeply wrong because you have not introduced the k-stars. So they did that, this kind of analysis, and again, you really have to work pretty hard to get this right. So there are many plots here. I don't really, these things here are the ordinary guys that we know and love. This is the would be pentaquark, but you see, as soon as you go above, you go to the region of physical mass where you like to be, it becomes very, very broad. If you want to produce it whenever with, you basically need to be so close to threshold that it's questionable that you're doing the right thing. So I was emphasizing this sort of chiral soliton approach because it's the one that I know better, and it's sort of historically the one that led to the prediction. But of course, people tend to have very strong opinions in this field, and to for some people, the chiral soliton model is just garbage. You don't even think about it. You do quarks. So what is a quark? A quark is, for some mysterious reason, something which is roughly of 1/3 of the mass of the proton. And you put springs, you put potentials, and you cook up some kind of quark, non-relativistic quark model. And it's clear that all attempts based on some kind of uncorrelated quark model, in which you put things in the lowest wave, in the lowest special wave function, is doomed to fail instantly. Because basically, the lowest special wave function is the one in which you simply take a wave function of the kaon and the neutron, you just put them one next to each other, and this will instantly decay, and you will have a very large width, so basically will be washed out. So you have more hope if you start playing the game of saying that, well, maybe there are strong correlation between quarks, and there is a so some beautiful ideas involving diquarks. I mean, this is a separate talk, but one thing you can do is you can declare that the UND, there are, remember, the pentaquark is UD, UD S bar, so you can declare that UD and UD want to talk to each other very strongly, and you think of UD as some kind of diquark effective particle, and then you are led to essentially mimic the quantum numbers of this semi-classical computational circuit model, where the theta plus gets positive parity. In this naive approach, of course, you can read off instantly that this is negative parity because the kaons are pseudoscalars. So, okay, these I really leave, if you're curious about reading about this stuff, it's quite nice. But I think even diquark enthusiasts would agree that, sure, if the state is there, you can accommodate it, you can contrive some kind of diquark model. But you see, as soon as you start putting correlation between the quarks, and you want basically this thing to be in a P wave, a back of the envelope calculation using quark model rules would tell you that the state is much heavier than that. The really puzzling thing they say is so light, and so if you put the things in a P wave, you gain energy, of course, and well, it's puzzling. So Leddy results are not very conclusive, but in the first approximation, either they see nothing at all, or it's a negative parity state, which we have reasons to disbelieve. So the real point of my talk is that the original prediction of the theta plus was accidental. There are many accidents about it. The sigma term was not the value that's now. The identification of this second state with the 17-10 was accidental. Much more relevant is the fact that you cannot trust the semi-classical reasoning. And in fact, if you are sort of bold, you could reverse the usual words that are said about this. The chiral solid model predicted state is not there. That's what I've shown you so far. What, of course, that means you need to input some dynamics. So you need to input the fact that more or less the Skirmer Lagrangian works for ordinary baryons, and if you can trust it for the exotic baryons, then the state is not there. Of course, if the state is there, we have to make peace with it, and you can probably contrive it by going to some funny region of the parameter space in quark models or in solid models, but then nobody has absolutely any clue of why it should be so narrow. If it's less than 1 MeV, it's not a hadron, pretty much. So if it is confirmed, it's a major theoretical challenge. If it's not confirmed, maybe we could say that large N wins again. So can we get any so of course, now my time is almost over, which allows me to skip this part, which of course is the interesting and confusing one. So I think David Mateos and his brother and Rob Myers have some nice ideas about how to do baryons in their setup with flavor brains. And sort of a very natural conjecture is that if you have some kind of setup in which you have D brains, like Karsh and Randall taught us, in which you can just probe brains and you look at the effective action on them as the open string theory, that should mimic, of course, our chiral Lagrangian. And where does the Vesumino term come from? Well, there is a Vesumino term in the brain effective action, and since these two things have the same name, maybe they're the same thing. Of course, there are sort of deeper reasons for that, but I think it's a very interesting exercise, and more than exercise, to study sort of baryon physics in ADS, real baryon physics. So we're not talking about the baryon vertex here. These are, if you have dynamical quark, you have a real baryon. And I think it's a beautiful project that I think they're working. I'm looking forward to their results. That's one way. So one way you could get such an object is again by studying this open string theory on these probe brains and try to reconstruct it as a skirmion, as a soliton of your effective action. Another way you could try to construct it is as a baryon vertex, in which you have the baryon brain in the bulk, and fundamental strings that connect to the flavor brains, and that looks more like a quark model type description. So as David was emphasizing to me, maybe we will have some better understanding of this sort of peculiar fact that the skirmion description and the quark model description are in some sense dual to each other, and in fact a large N one can precisely see that they lead to this. The universal Lagrangian prediction that the two type of models lead to are identical, and beyond that is dynamics. So, don't know what else to say. There are no conclusions. Of course, I think this is interesting. It's fun. If the state is not confirmed, we haven't yet answered the basic question I started with at the beginning. Why are there no exotics in QCD? We have no clue. If the states are there, it's even more fun because we have to find a way to fabricate them. And there are no... Well, I mean, my view is maybe a little extreme, but I cannot think of any single model that honestly predicts them and especially explains their width.
Questions?
Oh, by the way, I should have said this at the beginning. You should be kind to me because I'm not an expert.
you mentioned the Dyke-Quark model briefly. If I remember correctly, actually the Dyke-Quark model predicts different quantum numbers for the theta plus than
no.
The chiral solid. No,
no,
it doesn't.
The same quantum numbers.
Okay, then I'd have that wrong. But it also predicts that the Xi. Resonance should be at a different level than...
Right, okay, so I really didn't talk much about the Xi resonance, so because really only one experiment sees it so far. So the Xi resonance is, you're referring to, is this corner here, which has strange as minus 2. And, well, if you believe this semi-classical quantization, well, as much as this, you should take this seriously, you should take this seriously. But in their analysis, you see, in the original paper, this comes out to be so heavy that it's certainly going to be very broad. So you're not going to see it. In the Jaffe-Wilczek model, you get more or less the same quantum numbers. There are extra states. So in their model, well, not only you get this beast, but you get nearby object which has spin 3/2. That nobody has seen, and well, anyway, it's a very interesting attempt. We'll see. I mean, there was a lot of excitement at some point when this first result came about. I think the experimental result is 1860. So this is one experiment at CERN that saw or claimed to see this state here and this state here at 1860 MeVs, and that is a little bit lighter than what Jaffe-Wilczek had said, but not. I mean, again, you have to take these things very... So if the say was really there, I would say that's a triumph of Dyke Quarks, but we don't know. I mean, it's very preliminary. Only one group sees it. The similar groups that have very similar experiments don't see anything. So does that answer your question?
Yeah. Yes. And maybe another question. Since you mentioned gauge string theory at duality at the end, but that should only work in the large N limit.
Excuse me, you
mentioned the gauge string theory duality in the end too.
That's right. But these ideas are, well.
But if the large N limit is not supposed to see exotics, how?
No. I didn't say that. What I said is that there is no theorem for from large N that says that there is an exotic that is different from what happens for the ordinary octet and decuplet, where you just know from semi-classical treatment that the semi-classical position gets justified by large N, and then you know that the states better be there. Here, there is no such theorem, but of course, it becomes a dynamical question. You cannot answer this just from large N symmetry considerations. So, yes. What is striking is that in the simple models that we have that are produced correctly, the right non-exotic physics, the state is not there. Of course, we're not going to, if you see, unlike the existence of the black hole in SQL1 matrix model, which has become more of a personal question than here we will know, because I mean, within a couple of years, we will just know.
Has anybody looked in the bound state picture at the charm and bottom ones? Because in the black quark picture, they should be stable, I believe. And
I didn't hear you.
The
charm. Yeah. Yes. Of course. So that's a good question. So, given that the state gets more bound as you crank up the Kaon mass, suppose you repeat the analysis with the charm. Of course, if you take the same parameter, it will certainly be bound. Unfortunately, of course, the Skirmer philosophy, you start with the parameters of Lagrange in the SU3 chiral limit, and in the charm case, that's completely unjustified. So you really don't have no idea what the various coupling constants are. So you cannot, that conclusion would be naive.
I have a simple question. I just wonder when the experimental situation will be clarified and we'll know for sure whether the states are there or not.
I'm certainly not the person to ask.
But are the experiments planning to check it or what?
One thing that I know is that JLab has run a new experiment in the spring, and it makes me a little bit suspicious that they haven't. They claim that you'd release results by the end of the year, but they haven't yet. We'll see. I mean, but if there was a striking confirmation, you may suspect that they want to release. Oh, okay. You know.
Signal in the second run.
Yes.
JLab has taken about 20 times the original data, the class collaboration, which is the second plot he showed, and they finished at the end of May, and they were promising something towards the end of the summer. So, well, it's past the end of the summer. So either they're having problems, or we'll see.
We'll see. Yeah.
Well, let's say in 2 years, will we know for sure still there will be doubt?
Look, I don't know. I hope. I think so. I mean, it should be. I mean,
We should know.
I think so.
My legal
understanding of the sociology of the field is that we will know. But this is more a sociological question.
Maybe a little bit more theoretical question. Let's say that we are considering excitations without stagings, okay? So large N, and then we are considering this series 1/2, 1/2, 3/2, 3/2. Then the next one will be 5/2, 1/2, right? 5/5, 5/2, 5/5.
That's correct.
Okay, and it's already exotic.
That's right.
And it doesn't involve this order of N zero power correction. It's still within 1/N, right?
Right, but five halves is dangerously close to 3, you will admit.
Sorry?
5/2 is not very far from 3. So, you see, the point is that the you can trust this analysis.
You meant to 3 is the number of colors.
That's right.
Okay. but then
you can trust this analysis only as you have some kind of Born-Hoppe-Naim separation
scale. I agree. But then we should not trust to this excitation which goes. I mean, this direction in terms of stageness, it goes is essentially like n equals 3, because you have 3 divided by 3. Then even this, if this 3 doesn't exist, then there is no reason to believe that anything like, you know, this data would exist as well, right? Because it's about the same amount of data.
This is very different. So here you have a state.
You are saying that in QCD you cannot trust.
But this is very different. So this is a state that the large analysis predicts and we don't see it. So the theta is a state which is of order 1 above the ground state, and we see it. So it's sort of the opposite situation.
So I hate to cut off discussion, but we do have a long session this morning. So please let's let the speaker take the rest of the questions.